Welcome to No Better Time. I'm Phil Salter, naturally. And I'm actually driving to work today, and I'm using the plug-in Apple headphones. Let me see if the mic gets closer, if it sounds any better. Which seemed to be the best option while driving. Because I wanted to be able to record this morning. I don't like releasing these anymore without some kind of intro. So today is my interview with Dylan Tucker, who is my mortgage lending officer that I use for. He's a broker, or he works for a brokerage. I always get it mixed up. What is what? If he's a broker, I believe he's a broker. He's definitely a lending officer, or I don't even know. But he does home mortgages, and he's amazing. I was introduced to him by my brother Matt Salter, who's a highly successful and sought after a real estate agent here in Utah. So check him out if you're looking to buy or sell a home, by the way. I don't get anything for this, but obviously I am biased. But hey, he truly is one of the top agents in the state, honestly, and if not the country, because he's won awards over it, no joke. Anyways, I digress. I obviously am proud of my bro and love him very much. So Dylan Tucker, someone I was introduced by Matt, because Matt said, hey, he's awesome for mortgages, because I was considering maybe refinancing to remove my private mortgage insurance. I was able to successfully do that with Dylan, and since I've even refinanced other times to bring down my interest rate further. But anyways, it's a really good interview talking about what to consider and that kind of the mental process, but also in actuality, physically, what needs to be in place to pre-qualify before you go and try to find a home, put an offer on a home, and what if you already own a home, what about refinancing and all those things. So really good conversation, and he's amazing. I believe, oh my gosh, I was going to look this up and now I'm driving. We say in the interview how to contact him. And I feel like it's Dylan at Community Lending Group. That feels so right to me. So Dylan at CommunityLendingGroup.com. In fact, you know what? I'm pulling over. I'm in a residential neighborhood right by my house, so nothing dangerous here. While we're talking, I'm going to stall here for a second as I pull up my email history with Dylan, because I want this to be accurate, because Dylan's incredible. And I really feel like if you're in Utah and you're looking for a home mortgage, he's the person to work with. What I like about him a lot is he's been super responsive. Yeah, Dylan at CommunityLendingGroup.com. He's always been responsive and has been really just super helpful, and not someone that is trying to just get you to do something that will be to his benefit, like refinance when it doesn't make sense. Like there's been times, so originally I talked to him and he's like, this isn't the best time for you to do this. Let's circle back in 6 months and see where things are at. Cause I really wanted to remove my private mortgage insurance back in the day. Anyways, hope you enjoy this interview. If you have questions and things that you feel like there's some other things I want to understand around home mortgages, please email Dylan at Dylan@CommunityLendingGroup.com, or you can email me at nobettertime.podcast@gmail.com, and I can do another episode on mortgages and maybe even get Dylan back on. So please enjoy this interview with Dylan Tucker. And now I have to go back to the other screen where I was recording and say stop. Welcome to No Better Time, a financial journey with me, Phil Salter, as I learn about finances and investing. Join me and we can grow together towards a bright financial future, because there's no better time than the present to get moving on your financial goals. Dylan, I'm so excited that you were willing to be on the podcast and give me your time.
Of course. Yeah. I've listened to a few of the episodes and I really like what you're doing. I think it's great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Flattery will get you everywhere, sir. no, you're very kind. You've always been a very very awesome person to reach out to me here and there. You're someone I've met through my brother, Matt, because he's in real estate.
Yep.
And Dylan Tucker is your name. And you are a mortgage broker, I guess? Or what would your actual title be?
I am a broker. If you do home loans, you either work for a banker or a broker. I'm on the brokerage side. And I'm a loan officer. So I help people.
A loan officer.
Yeah. Purchase and refinance homes.
And you've done an awesome job helping me refinance, like, I think three separate times over the last few, like 5 or 6 years.
I believe, yes.
It's just the way the things have gone with mortgage rates. The first time it was because, I think it was because I was able to remove my private mortgage insurance. We were able to show that I had enough equity to do that. And so that was really nice. And then just, it was funny because at the time my interest rate actually went up with doing that, but I paid less because I got rid of the PMI. And then later interest rates lowered, did it again, and then lowered even more, did it again. But I think about as low as it's going to go for me at least. But Dylan.
You know, that's what I've been telling people. Oh.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying that's what I've been telling people for 4 years or so. Like, hey, this is as low as they'll go. And 18 months later, 2 years later, I'm talking to him again, like, hey, it dropped again. Do you want to save more money? But
I and you really believed it at the time, right? You're like, it can't possibly go any lower than this, right? But then there it goes. Absolutely.
There it goes, yeah. I mean,
but there's something I found that I've really enjoyed working with you is just your proactive nature, your communication. I kind of had been in contact with some other more, I guess, loan officers or people working for different brokerages. This wasn't the same. They were professional. They were good. They were not to say anyone I've kind of interacted with wasn't professional or good, but just you're on a whole other level. And so that's why I thought of you would be an awesome person to talk about this stuff on this podcast. But I always kind of start with a couple questions. And I sent them your way. So if we had a time to kind of think about it a little bit, I don't know if you saw that email. But one of the questions I'd like to ask is, one of the things I kind of think about is the relationship I had to money as a child and how that's evolved as I've become an adult. And even in my adulthood, how that's evolved even more recently. For you as a child, what was your relationship to money and kind of how has that evolved for you?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate what you said about working with me and that, like you said, flattery gets you everywhere. So thank you. My relationship going money, I didn't really have a concept of money until I got really my first job at 15, sophomore in high school. Before that, it was just, I relied on my parents and we either bought something or we didn't. It just didn't even occur to me that, okay, we're running out of money or no, we have to save up for this. Like, I just didn't have any concept of that whatsoever. So when I got my first job, I started making paycheck and I could go out to dinner with my friends and we just all worked from a really young age and kind of learned how to, okay, I have a phone bill. I need to play Snake as often as possible. So I need to make sure I have a phone bill. And it just kind of grew from there to where now I feel like I have a handle on things. I could always do better, but I feel like the system I'm using now to save and to spend, it's been working and I like it. It's different for everyone, but I found something that I'm comfortable with and it's been working. So.
Awesome. I mean, so it sounds like it kind of went from having really no concept of money, but then actually starting to work at a relatively young age and realizing, sounds like pretty quickly, oh, wow, money gives me the power to make choices and it gives me some freedom. And you saw the value in that. And so you continue to work and then over time learning to how to manage your money, save and do even more with it. So kind of sounds like a very healthy progression with money. And
yeah, there was definitely some times where it's like, oh, I spent all my money and I didn't get paid for a while. And I realized I didn't like that real quick. So I think that kind of was like,
which are valuable lessons, right? And you're doing this when you're younger at lower stakes, which I've always think is really good. I want to give my kids those opportunities to make those mistakes before it really matters and they're missing like a rent payment and they're getting kicked out or having a car repossessed or things like that. That's when it's higher stakes, right? So it's good that you could learn those things younger.
Of course.
And you kind of mentioned one of the other questions I ask is kind of what was your first way you made money? And it sounds like you around 15, what did you say the job was? I'm trying to remember what you said.
Actually, I didn't have a license. Did you say? And I probably should have been here, but I worked at Texaco Express Loop. So I did oil changes on cars, and I had to pull cars in over the bay, which is a big pit in the floor. If you do it wrong, you go down. And they didn't realize until I actually turned 16, and they're like, wait, you didn't have your license the whole time? And I was pulling in
cars. That would have been a good question to ask.
But yeah, I worked there, and then next to it. So just kind of manual labor, and I loved it. Got a job, hired with a friend, and we did it all through high school.
I mean, manual labor's that teaches you a lesson about hard work. I remember my first job was this in Southern California, a plastering, like built underground swimming pool service where we'd plaster the pools, right? And so we sometimes had to demo out the old plaster with these jackhammers, shovel it out, bring it up on a truck. And I was the mixer boy. You know, I've always been a pretty short, small guy. And this was when I was even skinnier and shorter and lifting up bags that weighed more than half my weight, mixing the stuff, pouring my whole body, pouring the thing down to get it into the wheelbarrow, carting it back, shoveling into the pool. And that was a good learning experience. But you also kind of learn, I don't know if I want to do this kind of stuff forever, right? You probably learn the same thing. Hey, well, how can I elevate my ways of making money? And maybe that's what led you to what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Was there a path but what brought you to working with being a mortgage, a loan officer?
It's the weirdest path. I went from manual labor all through college, and then I got a degree in criminal justice. And as soon as I got out, I went to visit my wife at work, and she was a processing manager. And one of the loan officer managers said, hey, can you pass this loan officer test? And I said, I should. I just got out of college. Like, I should be able to pass the test. So I studied for it and took it. And right out of the gate, I was like, well, I'll try this. I don't really have any offers to go be a cop or anything. And I've studied it ever since. So I have a degree that I'm not using. But
hey, well, I think that's pretty common.
Yes. But I absolutely love my job. It's as if I'm self-employed without actually being self-employed. Loan officers are W-2 employees, but you still have that freedom. You still have to go out and get your business. You still have a lot of the self-employed fears or challenges, but you have a lot of say in what you're doing as well. So,
yeah. So, I mean, that's a big thing with sales. I suppose it is a sales type of position, right? I mean, you're selling loans, I guess. I mean, not in a negative way, of course, but you're just, you need to get those opportunities. You need to build relationships, network, kind of word of mouth, getting people's trust. These are all very sales related.
Of course. Yeah. I sell money for a living. And it's crazy to think about, but not everyone has cash to buy a home and everyone needs shelter. So it's one of those things that it's kind of one of those, I don't know if a necessary evil is the right word, because it's not really an evil business, but everyone needs somewhere to live. And if I can be in a sales position to help people do that, I really enjoy it. And it's great to hear people like, oh, we're ready to close. This is so great. I'm so excited to stop renting. So excited to buy my home. So excited to upgrade or whatever. It's really rewarding.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, honestly, for me, it's really important work. Obviously, if you do it in an honest way, which you do, you're very transparent. Remember, you're just always talking through things and helping me make the best decisions, and not just a thing that's going to make me take out the biggest loan or whatever that or a way that benefits you the most, but really helping me decide what is the right decision. Hey, maybe this isn't the right time to refinance. You know, if you were just trying to get people to do it at all cost, obviously that would be a losing formula for you, because good luck maintaining people's trust. But it enables people to have a home, because how many people have enough cash to go buy a house? Almost nobody can buy a house outright. You know, there's some philosophies out there of like, not getting in debt and saving up and doing all these things, but it's one of the best financial decisions I've made. I should say the best financial decision I've made up to this point in my life. Hopefully I can make even better ones moving forward that may bring me more return. But buying this house about 5 years ago has so far been the best thing I've done And that involved getting in a certain kind of debt. So how do people kind of know when to take on that kind of debt? When does it make sense for somebody? And what is kind of the thing you help people to realize? Because if you get in over your head, that's a huge problem, right? It can be a big burden for people if they're not ready for it, right? It could be a blessing or the biggest curse, right?
Sure. Well, luckily, a lot of the programs that I use, they all go off debt-to-income ratio. So essentially, the government has set certain limits that they'll allow between what your gross income is a month, what your debts are on a monthly basis, and then they put a percentage to it. And if you're under a certain percentage, you can qualify to buy a home with a conventional loan or an FHA loan. They have different limits, but they still have those limits in place. What I find really interesting is a lot of people who are renting are above those limits, are paying higher than what they would pay on a mortgage, but the government won't allow them to go forward essentially with getting a loan at those parameters. So it's kind of crazy because they say, well, I'm paying, you know, $2,000 a month now, my mortgage would be under that. Why can't I qualify for a loan?
Yeah.
There are certain standards that have to be met in order to move forward. But I would say really the biggest step would be you just got to do it. You got to jump in with both feet. There's no better now, whatever time that is, whether it's this market where home values are high, but rates are super low. Or you can wait for home values to come down. And if rates are higher, you would actually qualify for less of a home with those higher rates than you would today with the higher prices and the lower rates. So it's one of those catch-22s that if your payment's going to be $2,000 at a higher purchase price and a lower rate, or $2,000 at a lower purchase price but a higher interest rate, you know, when do you want to jump into that? But rent is essentially going up every time you renew your contract. So you're kind of playing, heading down a hill with rent to where you can start building equity on a home. And certain people at certain times it clicks with, and others just say, you know what, I'm not quite ready. And when they are, we move forward. But you just got to, it's one of those things you just got to jump in and jump in and try. And yeah, it's a necessary.
Well, it's,
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's, here's the thing. It's basically, I think we have a delay, so I don't mean to, I think I'm cutting off sometimes unintentionally. but so sorry about that. yeah, I think that what you're saying, a big thing is that debt to income ratio, right? So that if someone was trying to get prepared to be in the best position, and which, like you said, is unfortunate, maybe someone really would be more likely to be able to successfully pay a mortgage than maybe the rent that they're paying. But something I did think of is there's no life without risk. If you're renting, your risk of next year rent going up, or when you renew your contract or your lease or whatever, or you're at risk of them saying, hey, we're selling this, we're kicking you out of here. That happened to me, I think, 3 years in a row. We were renting places and we were like, hey, we want to stay. When we signed the contract, we're like, we'd love to be here maybe even 3 or 4 years. We'd be happy to sign a 2 or 3 year contract. You know, lease. And they're like, no, it's fine. Of course, it come into the lease. Oh, we're moving somewhere. We need you to leave. That happened, something and that on that level happened 3 years in a row. And so you realize you don't have the control. You're not the master of your destiny when you're a renter. Not to say there's not a place for it, right? None of us are saying that you're an idiot if you're ever renting. But like at a certain point, yeah, you got to jump in with 2 feet and say, there's a certain risk. And there's going to be a reward. And maybe just because house prices have gone up for me a bunch over since I bought my house, there was a time when people bought a house right before 2008 where it crashed and they were upside down. You know, they owed more than it was worth. These things happen, right? There's risks. There's not, it's not always going to be like it is right now necessarily. Certainly not always going to be. But definitely what you're saying, if someone really wanted to be prepared and they're saying, I want to feel ready, or I actually want to, in actuality, be ready, because some people might just never feel ready because it's scary. Get their debt down, right? Their debt to income ratio. So if you can just explain a little bit more about what that really means, right? Debt to income ratio. It's how much you make versus how much you owe in debts, correct?
Yeah. So let's say just to keep things simple, let's say someone makes $1,000 a month, and let's say that that's a typical income, just to make things easy. $1,000 a month before taxes. But then they have a credit card that's maybe $100 a month. They have a car loan. Car loans are high dollar figures per month for a short-term loan. You're not financing a car over 10, 15, 20 years. If you can get 8, that's a pretty long car loan. So it's a lot of money to pay over in the short term. So if you have a $100 credit card bill, a $300 car, and you bring in $1,000, you're spending 40% of your income before you're even getting to a home. Those ratios that we've talked about are really 50% of your debt to income ratio. That's kind of a hard stop on a conventional loan is prior to taxes. If you're making $1,000 and you're already, say you have zero debt and you're buying a home, if your payment is $500 or less, you're going to meet that debt to income ratio because you're essentially using half or less of your income before taxes. That would work to buy a home, but
they count the amount before you pay taxes. So that's a little more forgiving.
It is a little more
forgiving. Okay, I thought you were saying the opposite. I was like, ouch. Okay, very good. Okay.
No, it's gross wages.
Okay.
But, today, if you're renting, you may say, well, I'm renting, but I really want to buy a new car. Some people will drive a really expensive car and have a high monthly payment, and that will stop them from buying a home. So I would say before you think about buying a home, kind of see where your debts are, see what you can pay off. If you have an expensive car, if you're okay selling that, getting a cheaper car payment, and seeing the end game as, okay, I'm going to get a house. Once I have a house, I can go get a car loan. They're not going to look at debt to income as strict with a car loan. But as far as the goes, they do have those items in place. So,
it really comes down to the payments you're having each month. Because I guess it's not really does it ever look at what's your total debt, or is it really just comes to how much do you have to put towards that monthly from your income, whatever your payments add up to? Yeah.
It looks at only debts that are on credit. So if you have a phone bill, if you didn't finance your phone, you just signed a contract, and you're paying Verizon or AT&T, that's not going to factor into your debt to income. If you're renting and paying utilities, or if you have cable, those are not going to factor into your, it's student loans, credit cards, installment loans like a car or a motorcycle, an RV, anything like that. And then a mortgage. There are a few other categories that factor into it, but those are really the big items.
The big ones. Okay.
So if I were to give advice for someone who is looking to buy a home, I would say, have a down payment. That's probably the number one issue that stops people from buying a home is a down payment. And there's a lot of confusion on it. If you have a conventional loan, you can put down as little as 3% of whatever the purchase price is. A lot of people think you need 20%, and you don't. 3% of a home, $400,000 home, that's $12,000, and you have your down payment. That's a goal that someone could work to save up to that. And it's reachable really for everyone. I mean, if you want it bad enough, anyone can, in a certain amount of time, can save that $12,000 to buy a much larger asset that is going to, with the Utah's market, it's essentially going to appreciate. It's going to become worth more the longer you own it, opposed to a car. A car, as soon as you drive it off the lot, it's depreciating. 3 years down the road, it's really lost a lot of value. A home, as it gets older, essentially you're gaining value on that. It's an asset.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the thing that's really cool about it is just gaining, typically speaking, on some level, it's gaining value just by existing. And as you're paying your mortgage, you're paying down the principal that you owe, meaning you have more equity, more money wrapped up in this house that if you were to cash out, because obviously if I have a $300,000 mortgage on a $310,000 home and I sell it, I didn't just make $310,000. I made $10,000 or whatever. I don't know what I just said, but you know what I'm saying? this equity is growing as you pay it. And in fact, I was looking at just doing the math on my mortgage, and I was like, if I wait 3 years to buy a house, just alone in my payments and my principal, maybe I've gained like 18,000 or something in equity just from that, let alone whatever the market raises to during that time. So, you know, if you want to upgrade your house, that's something I'm looking towards doing, is how much do I need to save so I can upgrade to a house of a certain more value? And that's part of my equation too, is what, you know, what I'll pay it off over the next 3 years or so when I think I'll probably move. But yeah.
No. And as you said earlier, you know, no one has cash to buy a home. It's usually people that are selling a home that they've already bought and are selling at a higher value because they paid the loan down. They may have the option to pay cash, but you usually don't have someone that goes from renting to buying a home cash right out the gate. They usually already have a large asset that they're selling. So,
And so you're saying that 3%. Yeah, that 3% is, once again, sorry, I'm not trying to cut you off. that 3% is, very, depending on what the house is, right? 3%, it's not like it's a small thing. Maybe for a lot of people, the idea of saving up $12,000 may seem impossible. But I would say change your idea of what is possible and your expectations of what you can accomplish. I know that's easier said than done, but really we can do anything if we wanted enough, kind of like you were saying. And it's something you can do, but really that first house, it's like get into that first house and then see what can happen. Because now I'm in a position to do so much more I can leverage with this house than if I would have waited. And it was a little more difficult in the beginning, but as I've made more money and things, it's become very easy to pay my mortgage. I never got myself in a position, and some people do, where you just really are house poor, right? This idea of you can't even buy food very easily because you're so busy paying this mortgage. And I think that was a lot bigger problem before the crash, right? Sure. People were enabled to make really big mistakes. And they've really buckled down, correct, to kind of keep that from happening.
They have. What's crazy is the loans that you're referring to in 2008 were, you could call a loan officer and say, I make $300,000 a year. And that loan officer would say, great, let's get you a home. Now, if they say, hey, I make $300,000 a year. Yeah, it was literally stated income. There wasn't pay stubs. Now it's 30-day pay stubs, 2-year job history, the ability to repay the mortgage is a new requirement for mortgage lenders. It has to be, they have to have a job. If there's a big gap in employment in that 2-year history, say there's a 6-month gap where you didn't have a job, the lender's going to look at that different than if you've had a job the full 2 years. They want to make sure that, you know, it's a good loan for them to lend money on, but at the same time, loans are safer now than what options were in 2008. A lot of interest-only loans, or if you bought a home for $500,000, 10 years later, you still owe $500,000 on that home. People were just banking on appreciation to buy it for that, sell it later.
The ARM loan, right?
Yeah. There's a place for ARM loans. There really is. But rates as low as they are now, ARMs are really about where the fixed rates are. So in this market, there's not one. But if rates ever went up to 8% again, you know, getting a 4% loan on an ARM that might be worth it to someone. So they have a place, but everyone is hoping for that home, that $500,000 home, to appreciate. And the next month it went to a $250,000 home and they were underwater, $250,000, and had to sell for less. And that really put them in the spot because that stayed with their credit for a while. Stop them from making other investments. And today the lending world is much safer. Not to say that homes won't depreciate, but with what we're looking at now, homes are appreciating extremely fast. And supply and demand, I don't see that really dropping. I see it maybe leveling off, but I don't see a drastic drop. There's just too many people that want homes right now.
With all this added protection, it can be very cumbersome to go through the mortgage application process. Someone were to start by getting pre-approved, right? That's where they do like a credit check. That's something that someone needs to consider, not just their debt to income ratio, but their credit score. that affects like their interest rate, correct? Things like that. And it's a whole process. Yeah. It takes time, to do.
Yeah. I would highly recommend, I have clients that will call me and say, hey, I want to make an offer on this home. I have to have my offer in by 5 o'clock today. And they haven't talked to me or any other loan officer. We haven't filled out the application. We don't have the job history. We don't have pay stubs or bank statements. And it's kind of a burdensome problem, very front heavy as far as documents go. Or I have clients that'll reach out and say, I want to buy a home. Can I get pre-approved? We'll do all the paperwork up front. They'll call me another day and say, hey, I just made an offer. We already have that pre-approval. We know their credit score. We know what rate. We know what the payment's going to be. We can make an offer and get that loan closed very quick, to where the other one, we're kind of scrambling as if we had a big test in college and the night before we're trying to cram for it. We've all been there. It doesn't work out that way. Like, if you study for it or plan for it, it's going to work out much better. So a lot of real estate agents, your brother included, they're going to want a pre-approval before they go take someone to a home. Because what if that client looks at a $500,000 home and only approves for $250,000? You know, your agent needs to make sure that you're approved, and so you don't see something great and then go see a home you actually approve for. We've all seen it on TV.
And be like, wah, wah.
Yeah, the reality show on TV where it's just like, oh, here's a great home that checks all your lists that you want. Here's what you can afford. And it's like a shack. And I was like, no, this isn't what we want. It's like, well, this is what we actually want. So it's good to know.
Like, no one walks away happy in that situation.
Yeah. The credit score determines your interest rate. Your income determines the debt to income ratio or the monthly payment you can afford. So if you have good income, low debt, and if you're paying your bills on time, your credit score, you don't need a perfect credit score, but if you have a 680 or higher, you're going to go for a conventional loan, which is that 3% down payment. So buying a home is easier than it seems, but it does take some commitment. If you have to have the newest iPhone that comes out, and the monthly payment on that is $200 a month or whatever, or you can get a flip phone that, yeah, no one's going to be jealous of, but your payment's way less. I mean, if you make those sacrifices, you can get that $12,000 or whatever that 3% down payment is pretty quick if you're pretty set on getting a home.
Yeah, and then that person needs to be prepared. The pre-approval stuff's pretty quick, as I recall, but it's really, you're really going for it. You put the offer in, they accept it. The process, people just need to be ready. Like, it's going to be very cumbersome, a lot of paperwork, a lot of documentation to prove what their income, their employment, what's in their bank, their debts. But a lot of people who are listening to this, I'm sure, are likely already in a home, right? And so I think it's good. Yeah. I like the idea of talking about this stuff kind of for someone who maybe doesn't know, what is that really like to get in that first mortgage? Now, just as like a final thing to talk about, before I let you go, what should someone be looking to know it would be a good time to refinance their home? Because I remember, to me, that seemed like a really negative thing. It's funny because I would think of someone getting like a second mortgage. That, to me, that was refinancing. I didn't understand it at all, right? I didn't realize what it really meant and why there could be benefits financially to doing that until I, you know, was in that position and talked with you.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned earlier, you refinanced out of your monthly mortgage insurance. Your rate was a little higher, but your payment was less. So really, there's two areas of thinking. Do you want to keep your balance as low as possible and pay it off as soon as possible? Or do you want to have the lowest monthly payment so that you have more money at the end of the month to maybe vacation more or buy that four-wheeler or whatever you have your mindset on? So it really depends. It's a personal decision for everyone I talk to. But a lot of people are like me, more in the camp of, if I can get my monthly payments lower, I can do more. I can pay extra on my mortgage, even though my payment's smaller, I can pay it off sooner, or I can go out and, now that I have that home, I'm gonna spoil myself. I'm gonna go out and get that nice car that I always wanted. because I just saved X amount of dollars on my mortgage, my budget work before, I can use that money to get that car I finally wanted. The old adage of people will say, oh, if you don't lower your interest rate 1% or 0.5%, it's not worth it. But that's really not the case these days. If you can lower, if you can get rid of your mortgage insurance and even keep your rate the same, your payment's going to go down. Your money that you apply to principal per month, that's going to be higher than what you were doing before when you were paying that monthly mortgage insurance, principal and interest. You've gotten rid of one of those and kept the same payment or got a lower payment to where more is going to principal and you're paying your home off quicker. Monthly mortgage insurance is, even though you have interest rate, it's the equivalent of paying a substantially higher interest rate per month. If you can drop it, it makes sense at any time. So anyone that has any questions can call any mortgage broker. Obviously, I'd love for them to call me, but they can call any mortgage broker in about 15 minutes. They'd be able to tell them, yeah, this makes sense. Here's what your payment would be. Does that make same sense for you? A lot of people I talk to say, no, that's not worth it right now, but keep me in mind in the future. And then we'll touch base again in the future and it makes sense at that time. So there's not really a...
And we've had those conversations, the two of us, where it's like, hey, you know what, let's touch base in 6 months. And I remember speaking with you at one point, because if anyone's not familiar with this idea of PMI or private mortgage insurance, if you can't, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, if you don't have 20% down on your home, then you have to pay insurance that basically protects the bank in case you default on your loan or whatever. Correct. So that they could, so let's say it's $200 a month. It's not protecting you. It's protecting your lender in case you can't pay your, you know, pay it off. Cause it's, you're more risky because you didn't have enough to put as much to put down, which means maybe you don't have as much money or different reasons, right? You're more of a risk, which is kind of ironic in that, hey, I have less money, so I'm going to have to pay more money. So it's kind of a hard place to be in. Did I get anything wrong there?
You explained it perfectly, really. It's, it's insurance for the bank. It's confusing because some people, you also have property insurance that covers your items in the house or your house catches fire. There's mortgage insurance. And then some people think that that monthly mortgage insurance goes to, if one of the borrowers passes away, that it pays off their home. Those are all types of mortgage insurance, but the one that we're referencing is the one that protects the lender. You're exactly right. If you pay down less than 20%, then it's more risk for the bank. And to be able to move forward with that, they do put that monthly mortgage insurance as an insurance for them that, yes, they're able to pay this back. We feel comfortable offering the home for less, or the loan for less of a down payment, because they're also going to pay us more. So it's kind of a, kind of levels the playing field for the lender and for the borrower, because they don't have that 20%. So.
Yeah. And so then if someone is in their home and they paid off 20% of their home, they could potentially get that mortgage insurance waived. This is not like an optional thing unless the bank says you don't have to have this anymore. Another way, the way I did it was my house had appreciated in value enough that I could say that I had enough equity that was at least 20% in the house. It raised in value at least 20% when you also included what I had paid on it. And so that's why I refinanced with you that time, is to then prove, I was able to prove with an appraisal, hey, this is worth enough that I have 20% paid off, or as good as, right, as far as it's a perceived value. So that's a reason to refinance, right? Like you were saying, so.
Yes. That's exactly it. People that bought even 18 months ago, I've helped them remove their monthly mortgage insurance just because they bought at a good price. Gone up. But for any listener out there, if you're in an FHA loan, you're not able to drop that mortgage insurance. It does have to be on a conventional loan for you to be able to get rid of that mortgage insurance. FHA, it's a little bit different, but if you have a conventional loan, you can do that refi, or if you don't want to refinance, you have a great rate, but you think the property value is there, you can call your lender and say, hey, I want to drop my mortgage insurance. They'll they'll have you pay for an appraisal, but if that value's there, they will drop your mortgage insurance. It's without a refi, but it just depends on where your rate is. With rates that have been declining so much, it's benefited all the clients that I've talked to actually refinance, get a lower rate, and drop your mortgage insurance that way. But there are options. There's a lot of different options. Mm-hmm. And again, for anyone listening, if you contact a mortgage broker, if they're honest, which I would like to say we have to take classes every year on ethics, so hopefully you're talking to someone who's honest, they would tell you your options and let mm-hmm. you decide and see what works best for you rather than just try and fit you into their box and to get a commission.
Mm-hmm. But you said something with the FHA loan. You're saying that someone couldn't refinance from an FHA loan to a conventional loan? Is that not an option?
No. They can refinance from FHA.
They would just need to go. They couldn't refinance the FHA loan itself. They'd have to go to a conventional if they wanted to drop private mortgage insurance.
To drop private mortgage insurance, yes. But okay. Just to be clear, you can refinance an FHA loan into a new FHA loan with a lower rate. But FHA does have mortgage insurance on all of their loans, regardless of your loan to value, or essentially when you have the equivalent of that 20% down in your home. Conventional, however, they do not. So to drop your mortgage insurance, a conventional loan is going to be your best option. But there's nothing wrong with an FHA loan. A lot of people get those. They're kind of known as the first-time home buyer option because they do have a little bit more lenient guidelines. But still, both of those categories are great options. There's other loan options out there. If you have a VA loan, you don't have mortgage insurance, even from the get-go. So, and that's a zero down payment. Hmm. So there's different options out there. Again, talk to someone to see what you qualify for, but nobody likes paying mortgage insurance. So if you can drop that off, lower your payment.
No.
Less is always better to pay.
Yeah, for sure. Especially when you're paying something that's really not benefiting you directly. It's just, you had to get the loan. You had to do it so you can get the loan. So that's how it benefited me, at least at the time, is sure. I'll pay this so that I can get this loan for now. But you're totally right. It comes down to finding a mortgage broker, reaching out to, and really to get all these. I mean, we've only kind of gotten to so much of the details of different things here. But ultimately, don't be afraid mm-hmm. to learn more, because I remember this kind of stuff used to really intimidate me, and it seemed like I could never get a house. It seems like this crazy, impossible thing. But if you find the right people, like a Dylan Tucker here, who can really help you understand what your options are and say, hey, you want to refinance to this kind of loan. This is a good option for you. You know, is it another FHA loan? Is it a conventional loan? Who knows? They're going to help you figure out what your best options are and if it makes sense for you and what's actually possible based on your income, your debt, your credit, all these things. So to that note, Dylan, if someone, I don't know if you're able to do this, but I'd love for you to say how people could contact you or your brokerage or whatever. If they wanted to learn more, if they live in Utah, I imagine in particular, but you might work with people in other places too. I don't know.
Yeah, I am actually loan officers, as long as each state has different requirements. I'm licensed in 5 different states. I'm in California, New Mexico, Colorado, Idaho, and Utah. But there are other loan officers in the state that may have 30 licenses for different states. So everyone's licensed a little bit different. If people have any questions, my email is Dylan, just my name, Dylan, @communitylendinggroup.com. And if they have questions, I'd be happy to talk to them. So.
And he truly means it. Dylan is really awesome. And obviously I have a bias here, but I have no reason to have a bias other than he's been great with me. He's not my brother. Maybe my brother likes him, but that wouldn't be enough for me to use him if he wasn't awesome. Because he's always answered my questions promptly. And to me, that's huge. Literally, I reached out to you and a couple other brokers kind of in the beginning. And of the three, you were the one that just boom, responded quickly, gave me direct feedback and information and worked with me and had conversations on the phone to talk through options. So to me, that was huge. And that was why I recommend you to anybody. So thanks so much, Dylan, for being awesome and giving me your time this evening to talk about this stuff. And if people want to learn more, and like I said, we kind of scratched the surface here. There might be other things people want to understand about, things to consider, or how they might go about improving their chances to get lower interest rates, and things they can do and things they should avoid doing, because we could have gone into that a lot more. I think the mistakes people have made maybe leading up to or after starting their mortgage application process, you know, don't go get a new credit card after starting the process, stuff like that. There's a lot of things we could talk about, and maybe we should have another meeting. I don't know, but.
Yeah. If we need a part two, I'm up for part two anytime.
Yeah.
But you hit the number one don't on a mortgage. As soon as you've been pre-approved, do not have a car loan run your credit. Do not apply for a new credit card. Do not go buy appliances for your home. There's been clients that have bought furniture for their home that no longer qualify for the home to put it in. So,
just listen to your broker, and if they should hopefully tell you these things, but if they don't, just know this. But definitely, Dylan, thanks so much. And if people have questions that they want me to forward to Dylan, of course, contact Dylan directly too. Dylan at what is it again? It's
Dylan, what did you say, email again? Dylan at communitylendinggroup.com.
Yeah, communitylendinggroup.com. But if people have questions they would like to have discussed on this podcast with Dylan or about mortgages or that process, you can always email me at nobettertime.podcast@gmail.com. I can forward those on to Dylan myself. But I would love for you to reach out to him directly, honestly, if you need information about mortgages. Thanks again, Dylan. You have a great night.
All right. You too. Thank you for letting me do this. Thank you.
Of course. Thanks. Thanks for listening. You can support the No Better Time podcast by going to anchor.fm/nobettertime and selecting the support button. But the best support you can give is by listening and engaging. I want to hear from you. Send your thoughts, questions, and topic ideas to nobettertime.podcast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message by going to anchor.fm/nobettertime and clicking the message button just below the podcast description. Please subscribe wherever you listen and rate and review if that's an option. Check out the video version of the podcast on YouTube by searching No Better Time Podcast, and don't forget to subscribe there as well. And if this episode would help someone, don't forget to share it with them and let them know about the podcast.